Welcome to the Pursuit of Learning podcast. I'm your host, Clint Murphy. My goal is for each of us to grow personally, professionally, and financially, one conversation at a time. To do that, we will have conversations with subject matter experts across a variety of modalities. My job as your host will be to dig out those golden nuggets of wisdom that will facilitate our growth. Join me on this pursuit. Disruptive technologies have changed the way we do business and the speed that information moves. But we still structure our companies the way we always have, with the traditional top-down leadership model. The question is, can we do it better? And the answer is yes. Today, I had the opportunity to talk with Brent Lowe, one of the authors of Lead Together, and we talk about a different way to work and scale your business. We talk about how to transform models of top-down leadership into human systems of shared responsibility and accountability through the concepts of self-organizing and self-management. If you want to change how your company does business, this is an episode for you to listen to. Enjoy. Good morning, Brent. Welcome to the Pursuit of Learning podcast. Where I'd love to start with you is to know, what's motivating you in life right now?
First thing that comes to mind is my kids. I think it's a bit cliche perhaps, but my kids right now are 15 and 16 years old. And it's an interesting time because I can now remember what it was like when I was 15 or 16 years old. And so being the best father that I can be, being the best influence, the best educator is top of mind for me right now.
Excellent. And then as it relates to your book that we're going to be talking about today, which is Lead Together, what are two or three things you want to make sure that we get across to the listeners?
Before writing Lead Together, my background was as an HR professional. And I spent a lot of my time building hierarchy and writing policies and things like that. And I came to realize over time that so many of our systems are really built on a principle of a adult-child dynamic, where the more senior you are in an organization, you're more the adult, and those that are working for you are more the child. And when we got into writing Lead Together, along with my co-authors, Susan and Travis, we really took a deep dive into what would it be like if we all worked in truly adult-to-adult dynamics. And so that's the first thing that I'd love to talk about, is just that concept of adult-to-adult dynamics. The second is that our world is becoming so complex now that the traditional hierarchy that we have come to know in our organizations, come to really appreciate in our organizations, is falling short now on the problems are just too complicated for any one hierarchy to solve it. And so that's number two. And then number three would be that as a early stage company, because those are the groups that I work with the most, are early stage companies, entrepreneurs, scaling companies. And in those dynamics, they always start out as a very organic type of coming together. So if you and I were going to start a business together, you know, we'd sit down, we'd have some conversations, you'd say, you're going to do some things, I'd say, I'm going to do some things. And it would be very just a creative energy. And that's the energy that entrepreneurs really like. And then as an organization starts to grow, often what happens is somebody comes along and says, well, you know, you need to start having managers in your organization. And in that moment, there's a decision made to start building a traditional hierarchy. And really what our book Lead Together is all about is, well, what if you wanted to do something different? How exactly would you go about doing that? How would you keep that entrepreneurial energy alive longer in your organization? So those would be the three.
So as we talk about that, and as we dive into the book, there's going to be some terms that we use pretty frequently.
And I thought what might be a good place to tackle before diving right in is to frame self-management, self-leadership, and TEAL, which seem to be three of the things we're going to dive into. Can you take our listeners through those, and then we'll jump into some of the books?
Absolutely. So self-management is really the concept where, if we think about that adult to adult concept, then how can each of us as adults self-manage our own work and do that in an environment that still brings us all together into community and into an ecosystem, rather than often when I explain self-management to people, the first reaction that I get is, wow, that sounds like chaos. And everybody just kind of managing themselves, doing their own thing. But the reality is that a really well-oiled self-management system has a lot of clarity in it and a lot of structure in it. And so self-management is really the concept of individuals managing themselves within a system that works. TEAL is, I actually prefer not to use the word TEAL too much because it is very confusing to people, but there are people that have studied society over time, and they've gone back and they've looked at how have we as humans organized ourselves, looking way back, you know, starting 10,000 years ago. And they did, through this study, came up with different ways that we have organized ourselves. And they applied that to a color coding system. And TEAL is the latest version of that. So if we go back early on as humans, we kind of moved in tribes. And in those tribes, there was one person who was in charge of that tribe. And then we moved into more of the hierarchy that we're all familiar with, different versions of that. Then we moved into more of a flat organization. And then we got to this ecosystem way of working that we talk about in Lead Together. And each of those has a different color coding system to them. So when we talk about TEAL, we're really talking about organic ecosystems with a self-management principle behind them.
So why don't we start then to give the listeners a bit of a flavor, instead of saving it to the end, as we did in the book, why don't we tell them, because as you said, immediately what jumps to mind is, well, wait a second, the hierarchy's gone. How does this work? How do I structure my teams and people? And so I thought you had some concepts being parallel teams, web of individual contracting, nested teams, sociocracy, and holacracy. Yes. Can you let us know what those are? And so that'll give us a flavor of the structure as we talk through how it works in its various flavors.
So in all of those cases, all of the different names that you just suggested there, really, they're all just different sets of rules, if you will. So if you think about, you know, playing a board game, you need to have a set of rules of how that board game is going to be played so that everybody that's playing understands, and these are the rules, this is the structure, this is how it happens. We all are familiar with one board game called Hierarchy, where, you know, there's somebody that's more senior and that person tells the other people that report to them how things are going to be done. And so through these other systems, then we have a different sets of rules and agreements. And it tends to boil down to a couple of things. One is roles. So a clear description of what a role is and what's contained in a role. And then the second is agreements and how those roles are going to work between each other. And you'll often hear the term flat organization, and self-management is often referred to as flat. And that's actually a misnomer. There are still hierarchies in every one of these systems. The difference is that they're much more dynamic. And so, you know, if you and I were working together in a hierarchy and you were my boss, then you would always be my boss and I would always report to you. Where in these other systems, we have rules around, how's this going to work? Rules and agreements. And so, in this case, Clint, you're going to lead this project and you're going to lead me. And in another project I'm going to lead and you're going to follow. And so we have that agreement. So Nested Holes is one of the models that you mentioned. And so Nested Holes is still a hierarchical approach, but it's hierarchy on purpose rather than on role. And so in that, it keeps one purpose is nested inside another. So if you just kind of picture circles and smaller circles and smaller circles, then the bigger circle is the main purpose. And each of the teams that are inside that are called circles. And each of those teams has its own purpose. The individuals may be moving around. People might be in different circles. People might be leading in one circle and not another. Where a web of contracting is where that's a system that works really well when, if you think more of an assembly line type of system where there's an input at one end and an output at another. And so each of the teams along the way has a contract with the team before it and the team after it so that everybody understands, has an agreement of how things move along the line. So in all of those cases, holacracy, sociocracy, they're all really just different sets of rules. And holacracy is an example. They have what's called a constitution. And really the constitution is just a set of rules that as adults working together, we're all going to follow this set of rules.
And so that's something we're going to be talking about a fair amount throughout the conversation is roles, rules, agreements. And when we think of, or when I hear what you're saying, we'll take it to my organization as an example. If I'm a CFO, now that term or title or role might not be there in this system because my job is really to pull together five or six people's jobs. Now you may say, well, wait, those five to six people are the functional experts in what they do. And they're probably mostly more experienced in those areas than I am.
Right.
For example, so my head of tax is better at tax than I am. My head of IT is much better at IT than I am. My head of capital has been doing that for 20 years. I'm just starting that. And so when we're focusing on something that's capital related, they would be leading. I would be following in that example. So I would really only step up into that leadership role when we're focusing on the area that I'm the expert in.
Right. And that's why we often like to think of our organizations as circles rather than pyramids, because when we think about circles and everybody's sitting around kind of a circular table, you in your role as CFO have some really important roles that you fill. There are probably multiple roles and multiple accountabilities that you have. It doesn't make you more expert in the other areas. So those individuals sit at the table as an equal. And so we think about it as equal humans sitting at the table, each one leading in different ways. And so from a CFO perspective, as an example, a lot of what you might lead in is strategy and helping guide the rest of the team from a strategy perspective, where your head of tax is that their expertise is tax. So whenever it's a tax item, they're going to take the lead.
Now, as we look at this system and all the systems that have come before it, one of the great things to lay on the table for the listeners in advance of us taking them through the deep conversation is what are some of the biggest benefits that you and your co-authors have seen to organizations that are using this? For example, do we have an increased colleague engagement? Do we have better hiring and retention of key colleagues, which everyone right now is looking for the magic recipe with the great resignation and what we're seeing. So what are some of the highlights that people can expect coming out of this? And then we'll take them through how to do it.
There's a statistic that's been around for a really long time. That is 85% of the workforce is disengaged. And if we look back over time, there have been lots of different initiatives that organizations have taken to try and change that stat and improve it. And it hasn't changed. And the reason is that we're kind of keep playing around in the same system. So we're still in a hierarchy, but we're trying to, you know, do hierarchy different. What we see consistently is in organizations that shift to more the lead together way of working is that employee satisfaction, employee engagement goes through the roof. It's near 100%. And so that, you know, is a big shift from 85% disengaged to really flipping it on its head, probably 85 plus engaged. So that would be first and foremost. The second, which has been really interesting to watch as we've gone through the pandemic, is that those systems that were already leading together in some form, they didn't really miss a beat because they were already in this adult to adult kind of dynamic. And whether we're sitting in the same office or not, we already know how to work that way. In those systems, which were very strongly hierarchical, you see that the most senior people in those organizations are trying to get those organizations back together as quickly as possible, because that's the only way that they know how to guide is to have everybody there so you can watch them and make sure that the children are doing what the children need to do type of thing. And so for the organizations that we've worked with that were already there, they just kept on plowing ahead, which was great. And then the third, I think, is if you think about a traditional hierarchy in what are the kind of the traditional benefits, is that there are a whole bunch of people on the front line doing work. They send all the information to the top of the hierarchy, where some really smart people take all that information, make some decisions, and then send those decisions back down into the organization. And, you know, there are certainly times when that works really well. And when we are now dealing with a world that's moving faster than ever before, with bigger, more complex problems than ever before, we need people on the front line to be making those decisions and processing the information, rather than it having to go from one manager to another manager to another manager to an executive to the most senior executive and then back down. And so in this ecosystem approach, whoever needs to talk to whoever just goes direct and it just happens. And so the speed is much faster. And then I think the fourth one, if I was add one more in there, is going back to what I said earlier about those early stage companies that really thrive on entrepreneurialism and creativity. It keeps that alive in an organization much longer. And where we know that as we bring bureaucracy into an organization, a lot of that creativity starts to slip away. And so it allows us to keep that alive longer.
And so if I'm a leader and I want to bring this into my organization, you highlight three qualities that leaders generally need to have to be successful at this. And those are curiosity, creativity, and drive for results. Why those three? Why is that the magic combo?
The why is interesting because I think it's, for us, it was an observation of what we actually saw and in the systems that we were working with. But that curiosity, I think, first off, is we are very wired to go to judgment very quickly. And when we're working in a system where we have a whole bunch of smart adults, we will make much more progress by staying curious in those discussions. Being able to have really healthy adult-to-adult communication requires us to stay in curiosity longer. In my work, I do a lot of coaching around interpersonal tensions. And almost always, when we get into the conversations, when there's interpersonal tension between two people, it's because one or both people are jumping to judgment too quickly and not staying in curiosity. So curiosity is really about developing better adult-to-adult conversations. Drive for results is very much around the fact that we all need to be aligned to a purpose and we all need to be driving toward that purpose. We can get very lost in an ecosystem if there isn't a guiding purpose for the system and if we're not aligning all of our intentions toward the results that that purpose is kind of outlining for us. And you'll need to remind me, curiosity, drive for results, and the creativity piece is because every system is unique. And, you know, if we think about hierarchy, you could go into one organization versus another organization that has hierarchy, and you pretty much know kind of how it's going to work and run. In Lead Together organizations, each one is a little bit different and requires creativity to create the system that's going to be right for that organization, that group of people at that time. And so that willingness to play is really helpful. If we get too anchored to, oh, this is the way it's been done before, so this is the way it needs to be done going forward, we can get very stuck. And so that creativity is really helpful.
Because a big part of what I was hearing from you earlier is we have change. It's speeding up. We need flexibility in dynamicism. And creativity is what gives us that, because we're always looking to say, well, the solution that worked last year when we were this size and we were doing X, Y, and Z was great, but now we're doing A, B, C, and D, and we're this size. And so we need to change, and we need to be creative and see how that change can work within the company.
And in my work, again, working with those earlier stage companies, but I think this applies across any size organization. We talk a lot about tension. And so whenever there's a tension in the system, whatever that is, the first thing we ask is, so what is the tension? Let's really just understand what that is. Then let's have a conversation about, well, what are our philosophies about how things like this get solved? And that allows us to kind of tease apart, well, what are our past beliefs about these things? And what are maybe some other ways that we could do this? And then we start to look at what's the easiest, simplest thing that we could try to help alleviate this tension. And that's where the creativity comes from, because there's lots of different ways to overcome tension. We tend to have, each of us, our own well-worn pathway. And when we can get creative and start looking at other ideas, oh, we could try this, we could try that. There's lots.
And that's something we're definitely going to come back to, because one of the challenges you immediately jump to in your head with self-organizing teams is, well, how do I deal with tension, disagreements, terminations? So we're definitely coming back to that in the conversation. One of the things that you said earlier was engagement goes to near 100%. And one of the things that jumped out at me that may cause that is you lose that power over relative to power among. And one of the things I want to talk about is a great section in your book is it says, studies show that people in positions of corporate power are three times as likely as those at the lower rungs of the ladder to interrupt coworkers, multitask during meetings, raise their voices, and say insulting things at the office. And people who've just moved into senior roles are particularly vulnerable to losing their virtues. So what I'd love to understand is, do we know why that happens? And what are the four different types of power that you share in the book? And how do we move from that power over, which seems to have so many bad attachments to it, to power among?
There's in that same section, we talk about the Cookie Monster study. And I love this. I love this study because it really does speak to, it doesn't take long for us to flip into that way of thinking. So that study basically had three students in a room doing an activity, and they brought a plate in with four warm cookies. And one of the students was called the leader, although they were all doing kind of the same work. And more often than not, the person who had been given the title leader took the fourth cookie. And so in that scenario, just so quickly, we jump into, oh, I'm the leader. I guess there's more prestige. There's more something that comes with that. So we talk about these four types of power. So the first one is power over, and this is really what speaks to the dynamic between adult and child. And so, you know, if you and I are working together and I'm your boss, I have power over, I make the decisions, you instantly are less powerful than I am because I've been given a certain title. And so that's one. The second is power four. And so power four is when, you know, if we're in a situation where there's somebody else that needs our help, then they can, you know, kind of directly or indirectly give some of their power to us to work on their behalf. And so a great example of that is when somebody's onboarding. And so they, you know, they need some help and support because they're new. And the third is, so we've got power over, power for, power among, and help me out with the fourth one.
Power with.
It's been a little while since I've been back in the book, clearly. Power with is when we share power between us. When you think about power among, or sorry, power over, power for, power with, it is a set amount of power that is being divided. And so in power over, the power is shifting to the person who's higher in the hierarchy. Power for is it's shifting sideways from one person to another. Power with, we're taking the power, we're dividing it up, and Clint, you have some power, I have some power. And then the power among is when we look at it as, I think about it in the way of like a candle, where if you have one candle and it's got a flame, you know, you can light another candle. Now we have two flames. You can light a third candle. Now we have three flames. All of the flames are equal. And we're not dividing something up. We're actually multiplying it. And so that's very much what happens in the lead together scenario, is where we really start to share that power around.
In the Cookie Monster experiment, as you were talking about that and as I was reading about it, it brings to mind back when experiments were a little more harsh than cookies. We had the Stanford Prison Experiment. Would that be an example of where they had in the study, some students became guards, some students were inmates, and by the end of the experiment, the abuses that the guards were putting onto the inmates were a demonstration of the negative side of that power over?
Absolutely. And in that dynamic, it's a really interesting one because you've got, you know, everybody was just a student walking into that room. And just because they've been given a certain role, they have in their own mind taken stereotypes of what those roles are like and lived into those. But there are certainly other relationships between inmates and guards that can be quite healthy. But, you know, we have these preset beliefs about how these dynamics should be. And so in, you know, general business, there are a lot of stereotypes and beliefs around how different people operate. And what we're really trying to do is say, hey, there are some other models here. There are some other ways to think about it.
And so what you just said right there, if we go back to that quote from the book, we said that it's when you are newly promoted that you're at your greatest risk of putting your virtues in jeopardy. And so might that be because we have this view of what senior leaders do and how they behave and how, you know, they rule the shop. And so we step into that role and we immediately start to act as we think we ought to. And it takes time before we realize, well, wait a second, that's not how a true leader actually acts. That it doesn't work. I've just lost six colleagues and HR's talked to me three times. And so it takes time before we truly realize, well, what is leadership and how should I be serving my people versus lording over
them? Absolutely, 100%. Couldn't have said that better. I think that really is what happens. And a lot of that is it's self-protection. It's our own egos of trying to live up to this new opportunity that we've been given. I often say, you know, when we get a new business card, not that most people have business cards anymore, but when we get new business card and the title changes on the business card, that doesn't mean that we've changed. You know, it's just the title. And so we have all of these beliefs that we bring forward. And it takes time for us to unpack that and start to step into that new role. And we see this in self-organizing systems, because what happens is there are certain individuals who have been in a lot of leadership positions before. And there are other individuals who have not been in leadership positions before. And so often those that have been in leadership positions overuse their power, and those that haven't been in leadership positions underuse their power. And there's a lot of educating along the way to help rebalance those patterns and beliefs that people have.
And one of the ways that we can bring up people's leadership or power, if you will, is the concept of radical responsibility, which seems to really underlie how you can have self-organizing teams, which at its core is whatever's on your list, you have absolute responsibility for getting that done. Do you want to dive into, for our listeners who've never heard radical responsibility, what we mean by that and how it's so core to these types of systems?
So if you think ecosystems and self-management and leading together, at the core have two principles at play. One is freedom and one is responsibility. And so you can see, I think, very easily when we step into an ecosystem, how freedom goes up. And the ability to do more of what I want. I don't have a manager telling me what to do all of the time. So freedom has increased. Now, if freedom increases, and that's the only thing that increases, that's where we have chaos, right?
Yes.
So what we need is we need responsibility to go up at the same time. And what will happen is if one or the other is out of balance, then they will have to reset. So if freedom reigns for too long without responsibility, then somebody's going to come along and pull that freedom back. And likewise, if there's all this responsibility but not very much freedom, then people are going to say, well, why am I taking so much responsibility? I'm not getting the benefits that come with it, and it will fall back down. So you really need to kind of to work on keeping those two together. And so radical responsibility really just helps emphasize the importance of the responsibility piece of that equation. And it really comes in, I think about it in two parts. The first part is, you know, if I have roles and I have agreements that I have in place with my colleagues, then I need to be responsible for those things. And as you said, nobody else is responsible for those things. I'm the one that's responsible. But then there's all the stuff that falls in between, kind of falls through the cracks. Because all of the roles and agreements that we put in place, there will always be other stuff that doesn't get covered off. And so if we move through our organization with the belief that, oh, somebody else is going to deal with that, that's somebody else's problem, then those things fall away. And then we're in a dynamic where there's more freedom and the responsibility isn't high enough. So we need to be able and confident enough when we see gaps, when we see things that are falling short, or we see opportunities that aren't being captured, that we speak up and we either take them on ourselves or we engage in conversation with our colleagues to make sure that it gets to the radar of the right person. And so two sides of radical responsibility, you know, doing the things that I've already said and committed that I'm going to do, and then also being willing to pick up the balls that are being dropped and helping the system as a whole find a path forward for those.
And then one thing that you seem to talk about a fair bit, and it makes sense, and I'd love to hear recommendations on how we do it, because if I'm being radically responsible for my area and I see one of my colleagues dropping balls and not being radically responsible, one of the things that seems to be a requirement is a willingness to call that out and to have that conversation, because a lot of this seems to be, I mean, we're adult to adult, we're peer to peer, seems to be willingness to have those hard conversations to say, hey, Ted, hey, Tina, I noticed you haven't been doing X, Y, or Z. Is that what we need to be doing? And how does someone develop that skill set when they're anti-conflict? They don't want to put themselves out there. How do we make sure that we hold each other accountable for our radical responsibility?
You bet. That is the most challenging element of being in this ecosystem lead together model. Because yes, if we truly want to be in an adult to adult system, then we need to be able to have adult to adult conversations. And the reality is that most of us don't actually really like or have the skills required to have true high quality adult to adult conversations. And so that is the beauty of being in these systems. And we hear this all the time, is that people say, you know, by being in this system and learning these skills, not only am I a better colleague, but I'm a better parent, I'm a better spouse, I'm a better friend, because we're learning how to have conversations that we didn't have the skill to have before. The way that these systems help is by providing coaches. So you're not there on your own. If you think about a traditional hierarchy, and let's say you and I were peers, and I had a problem with something you were doing, then I would most likely go to my boss and complain to my boss, who would then most likely go to your boss, who would then most likely have a conversation with you. And so, and you and I may never have a conversation about it, right? So what we're trying to do here is say, okay, it's Brent and Clint need to have a conversation. Now, if I don't feel prepared to have that conversation for any number of reasons, maybe I am conflict avoidant. Maybe I don't have the right skills. Maybe I'm too emotionally charged to be able to get my thoughts together. Then we have coaches in the systems, and the coaches can do a number of things. They can just be a sounding board and say, they could help me prepare to have the conversation with you. Or they could step in as a third person to say, hey, I'm here just to help you have the best conversation that you can have. And so we're not left on our own to do this. We do have resources to help us, and we can just lean on peers as well. We don't have to go to coaches. There are, you know, we'll have peers that are better at this, and they can help us. The key in these systems is if someone comes to someone else in the system kind of with a complaint about, you know, if I was to go to somebody else and start complaining about my relationship with you, Clint, then, you know, that person's job is to say, sounds like you need to have a conversation with Clint. Can I help you? Not to become like, get into the pity party with me and really kind of go down a negative road.
And so a lot of people may not be familiar with concept of sort of above the line behaviors, below the line. When we're those coaches, we're really encouraging everyone to exercise those above the line behaviors. So if I come to you with an issue, instead of just commiserating with me, you're saying, Clint, sounds like you have an issue with person A, B, or C. Let's have a conversation with them. And do you feel equipped to have it, or do you need me to be there with you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And we, in our work, we talk a lot about the concept of radical candor. And radical candor, a concept that was made popular by a woman named Kim Scott. And she talks about the importance of balancing two things, saying what really needs to be said, because often, you know, I could have a conversation with you and just not say everything that really needs to be said, at the same time as caring personally about whoever it is that we're engaged with. And when we can balance those two things, we're in a radically, what she refers to as a radically candid conversation. And usually, as humans, we're good at one or the other, but not both. And so we need somebody to help us. If we're somebody that's much more direct, we maybe don't do as much of the care personally as we need to. So we might need somebody to help us. You know, how would I say this in a care personally way? Likewise, if I'm somebody that really likes to maintain relationships and things, then I might not say everything that needs to be said. Okay, how can somebody help me be better at saying exactly what needs to be said while still caring personally?
In his Bridgewater Associates, radical candor is something that's foundational to their organization as one of the people that really popularizes it. Now, there may be many organizations, but whenever I think about it, they jump out of my head. Does that ring
a bell? Yeah, they, from my understanding, they are, you could call it triple radical responsibility, I think, in their environment. They certainly put that at the top of the list.
Yeah, for those who are listening, one of the things I learned in an article I was reading on them is if you're leading a meeting, people in the meeting have iPads and they have an app where they're giving you live feedback on your performance as the person running it. So when you rewatch how you performed as a meeting lead, you're able to see how people thought of your presentation skills, leadership skills, etc., at each moment throughout the meeting. So it takes everything to the next level of self-improvement and self-candor between the people. Now, obviously, something that jumps out then is if I'm taking radical responsibility, I have to have my own personal commitments. And I also need to have commitments with my team members and with others in the organization. So can you talk a bit about how these commitments play such an important role in this system? And I think it was, there was a concept that Bruce talked about, Bruce Peters, which was reflect back, recap by email, record live, the three R's as a way to always have a bit of a, what are these commitments that you're keeping to? Because I'm imagining someone who's never done this type of system before, and you share some of this in the book. You come into a new organization, you step into a meeting, and at the end of the meeting, everyone's sort of meant to know, what do I own? Mm-hmm. Right? Your traditional who, what, when list. Not one person saying, hey, here's the who, what, when. Everybody's supposed to know, well, what is my what is my when, and what am I committing to? Can you take us through that, sure. Bruce?
I'm going to separate maybe a little bit two things there. So let's start just first with a general concept of commitments, which is really what Bruce Peters talks a lot about. And it's this idea that as we're moving through our week, we're making commitments to our colleagues all the time. We're making small commitments, just in conversation. We're making big commitments. And when we're flowing through our week, it can be very easy to have those things drop, to forget them. And so what Bruce talks about is keeping a commitment log, where every commitment that he makes gets written down. And then at the end of the week, he carves out some time to go through his commitment log and say, okay, based on the commitments that I made, how did I do? Did I deliver on all of my commitments? And when you think about trying to maintain this adult-to-adult relationship, at the core of an adult-to-adult relationship and the trust building that happens there is that if I make a commitment to you, then you want to be able to feel like I'm going to deliver on that commitment. And if I don't, and if I repeat that again and again, your trust in me is going to go down. And it's going to be hard for us to have a true adult-to-adult relationship. And now you're going to have to come and have a conversation with me, you know, back to our last conversation and things. So what Bruce is really talking about is just highlighting the importance in these systems of if we make a commitment, we have to keep it. If we need to change a commitment, that's okay. then we need to come back and renegotiate our commitment. But just allowing commitments to drop is an issue. The second part, though, is when we're in conversation, we can often think that we're making commitments with each other, but we don't actually close the loop on that. And so that's what the three R's are really about, is how can we make sure that when I'm asking you, for example, to if you could do something and you say yes, that you're actually saying yes to what I was asking for. And so in the three R's, we talk about recap, which is, you know, hey Clint, could you just share back with me what you took away from our conversation, just so I can make sure we're on the same page, right? So I've asked you for something, and now you're going to repeat back to me. The second is review, which is, hey, do you mind, if, especially this is better if there's a longer kind of bigger thing that you need to go away and think about. Hey, could you, Clint, do you mind going away, giving some thought to that, and then sending me just a quick email back with your kind of recap or review of our conversation? And then the third is the record, which is, let's pop open a Google Doc or a, you know, whatever shared doc and actually write it out live, what we're going to do, so that you and I are actually seeing the same words on paper. Often we call, in a lot of our work, we talk about a definition of done. So let's just write out a definition of done of what, when this project is complete, what we'll be able to say is true. And so now you and I have aligned on these two, you know, we've both aligned on what it is that we're undertaking together, or that you're going to undertake.
So this definition of done, that's us saying we've committed to do, let's say, project A. I'm going to own it. You need that as part of what you're doing, Brent. And that definition of done is saying, when you give me project A for me to use in whatever I'm doing, here's what it needs to look like. Here's what done is.
Yes, absolutely. So the way that I like to think about it is, we kind of fly forward in the timeline to the date that it's done. And then we talk about what's actually there. What's it actually look like? What's part of it? You know, that type of thing. Anything from what would the table of contents look like to, you know, oh, it's a document, it's a presentation, it's this, it's that, so that we're all aligned.
So you're trying, in a way, to take the potential future tension out of the equation by being as specific, some might say pedantic, together as you can at the beginning. So when you get there, you're both happy.
Got it. Well said.
Oh, I love that. And thanks for correcting me on the commitment log, because I thought that was such a powerful thing. And one of the things I recalled Bruce saying about that commitment log is he looks at it every Friday morning, saves enough time in his afternoon that if there's any commitments that are outstanding, can still be done. And one of the things I think he said was, it also teaches you what commitments shouldn't I be making. Because you start to find how much can you actually handle? How many things can you say yes to? How many things do you need to say no to so that you can achieve the yeses? Can you share a little deeper on that, if I'm on the right track for the listeners?
I like to say the easiest commitment to keep is the one where you say, sorry, I can't do that. You know, and so if you think about getting to the end of your week, and Bruce talks about, you know, coming up with a completion score, you know, did I complete 100% of my commitments, 85% of my commitments? And so, you know, if we're constantly falling short on our commitments, committed this many things and only delivered this many, then at some point something has to change. And for most of us, it is that we need to say no to more things, that we're overcommitting and underdelivering. And of course, we want to be able to overdeliver, undercommit and overdeliver. And so when we have the ability to just reflect on, well, how do I do as a human in this area? And if we start to realize, I fall short here a lot, okay, what do we need to do about that?
I love that. And for people who don't realize it, a lot of times when you think about the concept of saying yes to things, almost every time we say yes to a new thing, we're saying no to something that we were already working on. And so realizing that power of having that conversation with a peer and saying, hey, yeah, I can do that, but that means I can't do this. Can you and I align on what the priority is so we both get what, or so all of us, because there may be other people outside of that circle involved, get what we need. And so we have the commitments, personal, peer-to-peer, maybe organizational, but the bigger the commitments become, the more they start to fall into agreements, which seems to be another key tenet of these operating systems. And there seems to be multiple different types of agreements that we're entering into. Can you share what are these different types of agreements that we might enter into, and how is peer-to-peer, how do we co-create these agreements, which seem to be more living documents than anything?
And that really is, I think, the difference. So a commitment is, you know, you and I have a conversation. I tell you, I'm going to send you a document. I'm going to introduce you to a person, you know, whatever. It's a one-time thing. Agreements are much more about how are we going to operate? How are we going to be together? How is our system going to work? And so there's three different categories that we talk about. Governance, which is the big decision-making kind of engine of the organization. And then we've got operating agreements, which are how are things within the system going to operate day to day. And then social agreements, which is more, how are we committing to be together as humans in the system? All three of them. So we don't need to take kind of a deep dive into separating those out. Really, at the end of the day, they're just three kind of versions of the same thing, which is usually it's a document, simpler the better, that just says, hey, here's what we're agreeing as to how we're going to work together in this area of the business, be it something more tactical, be it something more interpersonal, so that we have a touch point, a place to reflect back to. What we find is 70% of the value of agreements is in the actual just creation of the agreement, because it forces us as peers, as colleagues, to sit down and have some conversations that we might not naturally be having otherwise. And then the follow-on, the other 30% is, oh, now we have something written down that we can reference back to. More importantly, that somebody new joining the organization can reference. Most of the value is, if we're putting an agreement in place, we're probably putting that agreement in place because there was a tension, some kind of a tension that came up that said, oh, this isn't clear, or you have a different understanding than I do. We need to crystallize something. So let's have a conversation. Let's write it down. In a way, it's just another version of kind of a definition of done, if you will, of, you know, what how do we want this to look when we do it? And usually there's a draft that somebody will put together as a starting point after having some conversations. And then we'll get together as a group and we'll go through it. And that's the time where people can either say, oh, you know what, how about we do this instead of that? Or yes, we're all in agreement. Let's go forward with this, at least for now. And that's the one cornerstone of all of these agreements, is they can be changed at any time as long as we go through a appropriate process of doing it. And if I reflect back, for example, to, you know, we started this conversation with me saying that I used to be an HR professional and I was a great policy writer. What would happen is, I would go and I'd write a policy and I'd basically tell everybody, this is how it's going to be. Now that's adult child for sure. And, you know, now we would never do that. We would say, okay, I'll come up with a draft. I'll do some research and see what other people are doing. I'll talk to some people, but now let's all get together and we're going to agree together. Or if it's a bigger organization, we'll at least have a representative number of people from the organization help us to adopt this agreement, rather than one person or two people sitting behind a closed door and making it so.
So challenges you see with the traditional model, and I'll give a couple examples, and we can talk about how these would be improved through the models we're talking about today, is when you have that hierarchy structure. Let's take, you already talked about HR or people and culture, and I'm just rolling out policies and procedures. But an example that'll jump out to a lot of people over the last 2.5 years is, let's take COVID. A lot of organizations set up a COVID committee, and the COVID committee, generally I'm operating under the assumption in these organizations that the people on that COVID committee were doing a lot of research, a lot of work, having a lot of debates and conversations, and then rolling out policy and procedure. But if you're a frontline worker, or you're on the accounting team and you're not in the room, you don't know what was discussed. You don't know what was debated. You don't know what the conversations were had or the research that was done. All you know is someone just told me I have to come back to work, but all my friends aren't coming back to work. Why am I coming back to work? Who are these people that are just throwing these policies at me? Is that one of the biggest challenges? Is people feel like they aren't part of the process, like they aren't consulted? And that's part of what we're trying to do away with when we go peer-to-peer. Now, we probably can't get everyone in the room, but is there a better way to have them feel as if they're part of it?
So we're going through this with one of our clients right now. And, you know, what we're doing is we'll do surveys to the larger organization. We'll do focus groups to allow people to be heard. What we always clarify up front whenever we go into one of these processes is who is the decision maker. And so often where a big, kind of the expectation or reality gap comes up is because individuals feel they should be a decision maker, or the decision maker isn't clarified, or the decision maker is kind of some unknown person somewhere that nobody knows about. And so when we go through these processes, we'll say up front, in this case, the CEO is going to be the decision maker. And before he makes a decision, he has a strong desire to get advice from everyone in the organization. And so we're going to go get advice by doing some surveys and some focus groups. And then we're going to go back and we're going to take all of that information back. And then the CEO is going to make a decision. And then we have, with our clients, we have meetings called Team Connects, where 5 times a year we bring the whole team together, and it's similar to what people would know as a town hall, but much more interactive. And in there, he has the opportunity to explain, here was the situation, here's the decision, and here's why I made that decision. And then usually when we roll these things out, we will also do it in a prototype form. So we will say, this is what we're going to adopt for the next 3 months, 6 months, whatever the appropriate time is. And then we're going to do a retrospective. And so most people, if you or I were told, this is how it's going to be going forward, and you've had no say, then, you know, we're not going to be all that joyful to adopt probably. But if there's a more collaborative process, and then we're told, you know what, we're going to try this for 3 months to see how it works, because we don't know. We think this is the right thing to do, but we don't know. And so we're going to do it for 3 months, and then we're going to do some retrospectives. And a retrospective is just basically pulling some people together and asking some questions and collecting some learning so that we can make the next decision. And the next decision might be, hey, we're going to keep doing what we were doing, or we're going to tweak this and we're going to tweak that. And so it becomes much easier to adopt something where, oh, well, I could do it for 3 months and see how it goes, you know, and then I know that I'm going to have a say at the end of that 3 months to provide some more feedback.
And so one of the things that you talked about earlier was the surveys, right? And getting as many people to weigh in on something as possible. And I think in the book, you talked about a concept that shows when you survey a large population, you almost always get a better prediction or forecast than if you just use one person choosing it. And I think there was a, if I recall correctly, there's an app or a tool that you suggested we could use, Brent, that allows us to sort of do those quick iterative surveys of our teams. So it's not a laborious process each time. Yeah. Do you recall?
So what we're talking about is collective intelligence. And it's the idea that the collective is much smarter than the individual. And so I believe we can put this in the notes that go along. I believe it's called Swarm AI, if I'm remembering correctly. And that's one tool of many that allows you to just go out and survey the collective to get ideas and then build on ideas and, you know, tap into the collective intelligence of the whole.
Oh, I love that. And so you've already started talking about something that probably a lot of people think would be challenging with these types of organizations, which is decision making. And so what really jumps out is, well, who makes decisions? How are decisions made? How do you wrangle or herd all the cats? Because that's probably what a lot of people are picturing a little when we talk about self-leadership. Well, if everybody's off in their own corner, how do we bring them together to make these decisions? And so you talked a little bit about we have a designated decision maker. And then the next step would be, what's the process for making that decision? And some of the things you talk about that are important are consent, generative decision-making. What are some of these key concepts to take us from start of a conversation to we have a decision made when everybody's got power in that relationship?
So I'd love to start first by talking about what it isn't, because this is probably one of the biggest hurdles from a decision-making perspective in organizations that are just starting down this journey. It's not consensus. So there is this tendency to feel that, we're much more, you know, we have to have everybody involved in the decision. And that, you know, I'm sure we all have experiences of how consensus can be slow and arduous and lead to a watered down decision. So we're not talking about consensus. We're talking about consent decision making. The difference is that in consent, we as participants in the decision-making process are consenting to an individual or consenting to a process and not needing for our ideas to be fully adopted. And we are not requiring that everybody involved is 100% feels it's like a 5 out of 5. So how we do that, there's two types of consent-based decision-making that we talk about in the book. One is the advice process and the other is generative decision-making. The advice process is where one person has the authority to make the final decision. And that either comes because it's part of their role. So in their role, it's one of their accountabilities to make decisions like that. Or in situations where it's not defined by a role, that individual has been given the authority to make that decision. And the way that usually works is, again, it kind of comes out of that set of rules that we talked about a while back around, depending on the system you're in, the system will define kind of who has the ability to define who has decision-making authority. So once somebody is the decision maker, their job is to go out and seek advice from two groups of people. One group is those that are impacted by the decision that's going to be made, or a representative group thereof, if it's too big. And the second is subject matter experts from either inside or outside the organization. So you can imagine if I'm going to make a decision, I'm going to go talk to the people that are going to be impacted by the decision I'm going to make, and I'm going to go talk to people that have made decisions like this before. Then by that point, I've had a lot of different ideas thrown my way and probably some conflicting ideas. It's my job not to try and blend all those together to make consensus and make everybody happy that's given the advice. My job is to take all the advice that I've had using my best judgment to make what I believe to be the best decision for the organization, and then to communicate that decision outward. So I like to say, you know, if the decision was what paint color are we going to use, and one person says red and another says blue and another says yellow and another says green, my job as a decision maker is not to go mix all those colors together and put it on the wall, right? My decision is to pick one of those four based on what I heard from people and what I learned in the process. So that's the one kind of decision making. We do this all the time already in our day-to-day life. This just makes it much more obvious of what we're doing. The other is called generative decision making. And this is where we actually bring a group together and make a decision on the fly. There are a number of steps to this process, so I won't go through all the steps. But the idea is that everybody has the opportunity to be heard. Everybody has the opportunity to give their perspectives and raise their concerns. And then the group needs to either adopt the proposal that's been put forward or come up with a valid objection as to why we shouldn't as a group adopt that. And there's some very clear rules again around what a valid objection is. And so then you have to integrate the objection. So we use generative decision making for really big decisions that are going to impact the system and the way the system works. Most other decisions would go to the advice process.
And so for our listeners, if we take another concept where I first learned it was Amazon and where I've written about it, and I did see it in here, is type one decisions, I believe, are our decisions that can be quick. We can go through the door. We can come back through the door. They're reversible. Those decisions, advice decisions. Type two decisions, there's no, for our listeners, it's more of a closed door. Once we go through, there's no coming back. We've changed fundamentally the organization or the structure or the team. Those type two decisions are more generative decisions.
Right. I agree. And another way I've heard it described is kind of above the line, below the line decisions. If you think of a boat in the water, and if you're going to, you know, if there's a risk that there's going to be a hole in the boat above the waterline, okay, that's not great, but we're not going to sink. If there's a chance that it's going to be below the water and it's going to sink the ship, then we need to get more people involved.
Well, that's great. I love that example. It's even easier to use than the door, because whenever you use the door, people say, well, what? I don't get it. Well, what's an example? And you try to walk them through it. So decisions are the key to how we move forward as an organization, right? If we make the right decisions, we succeed. If we make the wrong decisions, we fail. Probably one of the greatest things, the decisions aside, is whether we understand whether they were the right decisions or not. And so where that comes in is feedback. And there's a lot that you talk about in the book about feedback. And two things that I thought maybe we could go through, there was one where you said, well, let's go beyond feedback to a concept of mutual curiosity. And the other one was this concept of what, so what, now what? Can we tackle those two and talk about how we use them to have that iterative decision-making and assessment process?
So our brains as humans can only be in one of two places at a time, either judgment or curiosity. And for many of us, especially those that are more traditionally wired for leadership, we are trained to go to judgment very quickly and have our own opinion strongly held. When we are aiming to have good conversations, the more that we can stay in curiosity and understand another person's perspective, the more information we get on the table, and also the more meaning behind the information. Because often we can have the information. It's that, you know, you and I could go and into the same meeting and hear this one person say the exact same thing. So you and I heard the same thing, but walk out with totally different understandings of what we just heard. When we get into curiosity, we get to understand, well, why is that? what are the things behind the scenes? What are the background, what's the background history that has led us to that place? It gets us to understand each other better. Most feedback that we give to each other is subjective, unless there is very concrete data that, you know, A was supposed to go to B and A didn't go to B. Everything else is subjective. And of course, I think my subjective feedback is right. And you probably think your subjective feedback is right. It's until we get into curiosity that we're able to kind of bridge those two things together. So that's the first part around curiosity. To then extend that to this concept of what, so what, now what, it's really the same type of concept. So what is the data? What is actually what happened without putting our own subjective flair on it? The so what is, okay, now that we have the actual what, why does that matter? What was the impact of that on the organization? And then the now what is, okay, now that we've figured that out, what are we going to do? And we tend to be okay at talking about the what and so what in some version, and then often fall short on the now what of, okay, what are we going to collectively do to try and make some improvement here? And so in all of the different areas, like for us, feedback is about feedback loops. It's a necessary element of any system.
Yes.
To have feedback flowing through the system so that the system can learn from itself. And because the system is really people, it's, you know, that ability for information to flow. And we use a lot of retrospectives in our work. And retrospectives we use because everybody comes into a retrospective as an equal. And you can just, whether it's two people or whether it's a whole group of people, they're sharing their perspectives and also listening to other people's perspectives and getting the what and so what out in a very collegial way. And then moving to a now what. Now that we've got the full perspective, I've heard your views, I've got my views, now let's talk together about what we're going to do about that. Rather than me coming in and saying, okay, Clint, let me tell you how it's going to be. This is what I saw. This is what you need to do differently next time. We're co-creating that together through a retrospective.
And through that retrospective, we're able to examine the feedback as objectively as possible, look at the data. What did it tell us? What are we going to do? And we're coming out of that with a new commitment to each other, or a re-upping, re-anting of the commitment we already had, and getting back on the same page.
That's right.
Okay. And so we talked a lot about the system and how it works and how it operates. And people, obviously, there's much more in the book for you to deep dive into and to understand. Where I'd like to take us now is to the people, because obviously the people this works with aren't everybody. So we need to ensure that we have the, to borrow from Jim Collins, that we have the right people on the bus in the right seats. And so the first thing that jumps out to me is in the hiring process, if I want to know that someone is going to work in my self-governing organization, what are the traits of that person that I'm going to be looking for? And what are some concepts that I should be building with my team to ensure that we have the right recruiting practices?
So I think the answer to that question varies a little bit by every organization, because as we said, you know, we're creating in this ecosystem way, every organization is a little bit different. That said, there are certain characteristics that are more important likely than others. So for example, we talked about responsibility and the ability to step into responsibility. So that would be one. Another is grit and this ability to stay in the game. Because, you know, not all this stuff is easy. We talk about the fact that, you know, if you look at traditional hierarchy and 85% of people being disengaged, that's a big challenge. 85% of people disengaged. If you look at ecosystem, well, ecosystem has its challenges too. You know, we have to have these adult-to-adult conversations, which are difficult. there's more likelihood that we're going to, you know, maybe step on each other's territory a little bit and for interpersonal tensions to arise and things like that. The way that we look at it is in either way, on either side, there are challenges that need to be overcome and work that needs to be done. In the ecosystem way, the lead together way, we're working on things that make us better humans. And it's worth the journey, but it takes grit to stay in that journey. So that would be another one. We talked about creativity and this ability and willingness to try new things and experiment and get creative with solutions and not be too anchored. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about today that some organizations in that work this way have are self-setting and transparent salaries. That's a whole nother conversation. But if we bring it into bring it into the recruiting process, a friend of mine recruits for an organization that is that uses self-setting salaries, and he talks about the story about interviewing a candidate and saying, you know, how do you feel about coming into an organization where you're going to set your own salary? And I've never done that before. It sounds like it'd be interesting. And his response is, no, it's going to be hard. It's going to be very hard. And so that willingness to, you know, both be creative and trying new things like self-setting salaries, which most people would say, wow, that sounds wild. And then the ability to step into and practice some of these things that are so out of the norm for what we're used to.
It's a bit of a digression, but if we go on that, you can see that it's hard for people because even in the current system, and by current system, hierarchical system, when you look at salaries and someone comes to their annual performance review, often they'll come not having done any work. I just want a raise. Well, how much of a raise do you want? Well, what's fair, right? Like, what is the work that you've done to say what's fair, to say that what you deserve? Have you gone out and looked at peer companies? Have you assessed the rules to the roles to make sure it's apples to apples, oranges to oranges? Are you considering base, bonus, benefits, full package? And is that full package apples to apples? And then you may examine, well, how are you performing relative to your peers? How's the company doing? How's the economy doing? And you find that a lot of people aren't willing to do that amount of work to say, well, here's what my salary should be. Does that resonate with why he's saying, hey, this is going to be a hard process?
Absolutely. And it also becomes a hard process. So there's that half of it. I agree with everything that you just said. And then the other half of it is by going through the process, we are having, for most of us, compensation is one of the most intimate conversations that we can have within the workplace because it speaks to our value. And it's the one way that we kind of value and rank ourselves against others. And so there's a whole psychological element that we have to dig into and be willing to explore our own relationship with money and how our value is associated to other people's value. And it's deep work. Again, it goes to, is it the right kind of deep work that makes us better humans? Yes. Is it hard and work that not all of us are ready to do? Yeah.
I love that. We'll transition away from that one now so we don't get into too much trouble on the podcast. So the last one I want to throw at you, and then we'll check if there's anything you want to dive into that we might have left out, because there's a lot of information in the book, Brent, is this one was a little challenging for me. As a CFO, some things that are very important to me don't necessarily seem to align with the self-organized model, right? And I'm talking my 10-year plan, annual targets, budgets, cash flows, which are the traditional, what you refer to as predict and control, which you're absolutely right. That's how I've been raised, is we set the direction and we march every year and we hit it in 10 years. And in the self-organizing model, they have this concept of sense and respond. So can you bring our leaders up to speed on, well, what are the differences between these two methods? And why are we seeing companies transition from one to the other? And is there room for a hybrid approach?
Okay, well, I'll answer that question first. So yes, there is room for a hybrid approach, and I'm actually an advocate of that. So sense and respond is when we are going along, we have information flowing at us on a constant basis. And if we're sensing and responding, we're taking that information in, we're making a decision based on it, and then we're moving forward and waiting for the next information to come in. And so we're just adjusting as the new information comes in, versus predicting control is setting a target 1 year out, 3 years out, and then charging ahead, which the pro of that is it does speak to that getting everybody aligned. And we talked about that earlier around purpose. And I think this is another way to, you know, make sure everybody understands where we're all trying to go. So that's the pro. The con is that sometimes it can put blinders on, and it, you know, we just keep going in a direction when the rest of the world is starting to shift, and we're not taking the time to sense into what are we hearing from the marketplace. Early stage companies, they're sense and respond all the time. You know, it's very rare that an early stage company has a budget that they can stick to and targets that they know how to set. When you get a much larger organization that is much more predictable, say a bank is an example, okay, we've been doing this for a century and we kind of know how things are going. So there are certain organizations that predicting control can have more, is a more likely fit. Others where sense and respond is a more likely fit. But what we tend to advocate for is something in the middle where you do have some sense of here's where we're trying to get to, and here are some numbers that we're working with, and also not becoming so anchored to those that we miss out. And so, you know, it's similar to agreements. It's, you know, the budget is nothing more than an agreement that we're making with each other. And an agreement can be changed at any time if we sense new information. So let's keep sensing. And, you know, a lot of predicting control happens with a small number of people behind a closed door. Sense and respond is very much a wide open playing field of different people bringing their own sensing to the table.
So again, flexibility, dynamic, and as things are changing live, we're updating our expectations, our predictions, and the direction that we're going. So we're not stuck in that line. And then even if that line has become the wrong line to be taken.
The example that I love is a farmer. And so a farmer can look ahead and plan, you know, I need to turn my fields over every so many years. And, you know, I want to be making more money from my crops as time goes forward and that type of thing. But I don't know if it's going to rain tomorrow. I don't know how much sun we're going to have. I don't know when the snow is going to go away. So I have to be sensing on a day by day, week by week basis as I'm watching my fields and adjusting. And that may mean that some of the longer term plans that I had need to shift because of that. And that's okay. So just kind of keeping that healthy balance between the long and the short view.
And recognizing, and here's what really jumped out at me now that you say it, I'm a lot more comfortable, is different organizations are going to have different ability to predict and control than others. So for example, I'm in real estate. When you buy land, you know, well, okay, this land's going to deliver revenue 5 years from now. You don't necessarily know that on day one because you have to get through the entitlement process. But once you're through that entitlement process and you've sold the homes, you know, I've pre-sold these. I'm going to get this much revenue this year, this year, this year. That's done. I've got this many projects. So your ability to predict becomes much higher. Recognizing there's a lot of things you can't predict. The interest rate changes that we've all been seeing over the last year, a lot harder to predict.
That's right. And, you know, I have a friend of mine who is now talking to builders about offering home systems, automated systems in homes. And builders are saying, oh, we've never offered that before. That's interesting. We could do that. And so, you know, you could, as a builder, just keep building homes, or sensing, oh, things are shifting. Like, we need to offer this automation in homes that we've never offered before. Oh, that's exactly. An interesting new offering.
Yeah, it definitely 100%. And if you're, for example, building an apartment building, what do people really want now that they're all working from home? Well, they want to know that their Wi-Fi signal isn't going to drop. They'd probably love to be able to walk throughout the whole building, still be connected to, instead of their apartment Wi-Fi, building Wi-Fi. Right. So they can go down to the common area, bring their laptop, and they still have their signal. So as developers, we're all thinking about, how do you make this seamless for the owners? 100%. So, Brent, what have we not covered that you really want to make sure we get across to our listeners?
I think first and foremost, like, there's a lot of stuff in the book. And the reason that I personally wrote the book, which might be a slightly different than my two co-authors, is because I wanted the guide to have on my desk for when these things come up. So, you know, there's certain things you asked me today and I'm like, I can't quite remember the, you know, what's the fourth thing or whatever. That's why I wrote the book, because I can't keep all of this stuff top of mind all the time. And so the book has been written. The first third of the book is kind of more conceptual type things. And the last two thirds of the book are kind of all the step-by-step experiments. And it really, the book is an invitation to experiment with stories from, we have over 60 different companies in the book. And these are all things that people have tried. And they are most likely not perfect or ideal for any of your listeners in their current form, but they are thinking, they stimulate different thinking. I think we've covered a lot of stuff today that's a little out of the norm, and there's lots of things that we haven't covered, but that's okay. I think the intention of the book is, when you face a certain challenge, flip to that chapter and read about what some other people have done to overcome this challenge and see if something like that might work for you. So thank you for the questions, and also thank you for reprompting me on some of the stuff that I didn't have top of mind, because there was a lot in there.
Yeah, and thank you. And what I really realized as I read it is I quite identify with this type of leadership, because it just feels more collaborative, more, I think I would thrive peer-to-peer versus adult-to-child, as you described it. And what really jumped out at me too is it can be a spectrum. And so we may not be fully self-governing, but we also may not be fully hierarchical. Yes. So we may have that blend of, hey, we're getting close to peer-to-peer. We may still have the structure, but we can act in certain ways, maybe even within a team of a broader organization. We can have our team be a bit more peer-to-peer, and we can have some of these concepts. And that's what people can really take away from your book, Brent, is once you have all the concepts, what parts and pieces and tools can I use in my organization to make it a bit more collaborative engagement and engaging for my people? So I really appreciated that about the book. Thank you. And where can our listeners find you and your co-authors?
So online at leadtogether.co is the website for the book. And you can find me at brentlow.com. And I would love to engage in a conversation along with my co-authors. All three of us just love to explore challenges. So if any of your listeners have been, if something's caught their attention and there's a challenge or a tension in their system and they're wondering, what could I try here? Then we'd love to hear from you and talk about it.
Perfect. Thank you. And really appreciate it having you on the show today.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on The Pursuit of Learning. Make sure to hit the subscribe button and head over to our website, thepursuitoflearning.com, where you will find our show notes, transcripts, and more. If you like what you see, sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, your host in learning, Clint Murphy.